should be Thomas Sedlacek somewhere. Yes, here you are. You got this.
I got this.
Congratulations.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
So, if I understand, we keep on speaking English. Sorry for that. So you are known as an economist, acting in the academic field and acting in the financial institutions too. You have published recently a book which is considered as a bestseller, Economics of Good and Evil, and I would like to reflect, to discuss that book, if I understood it, the reason for which we are here. You consider, if I get your point, you will present this evening a session, a theater session, where you will at some point make your points. So my questions will be about how you do. What are you doing with the text? How are you questioning the texts? So my questioning is not about your answers, it is about the way you address the reading. Alors, if I take an example, something very interesting is that you go to texts which are not supposed to be written by economists, and you read them pointing out, relevant economical issues. That's one side of the question. And you add a symmetry, which is that you address moral issue reading economical texts. So this is, I take it. But my question is, how do you select your text? What is a relevant text for you? For instance, in the French literature, there are between 15,000 and 18,000, there are 4,800, it has been computed by a bibliographer one day, texts that deals with moral ethics and economy of that time. So what would you advise me for selecting the text in order to build up the type of analysis that you do?
Okay, well, so what I did is I tried to really look for, in various times and in various, let's say, epochs, where do we hide our faith and where do we hide our ethics? Where does our ethics come from? And my claim is, I think, a bold one. We used to hide it in religious texts, in philosophical texts, in ethical texts. Today we hide it in economics. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's a zero belief system. It looks like it's a positivistic, it's a zero value system. But in fact, the exact opposite is the case. Let's take an example of interest rate, for example. Interest rate today appears to be an extremely technical, mathematical issue. But in fact, if you look in any literature a little bit older, it has been a height of a moral debate. Today it continues, only we don't know about it. We've sort of swallowed the morality and we take it technically. So, you know, one way, a stupid example, when the Pharisees come to Jesus, ask him, who's my brother? I really think they're asking him a technical question, who can they charge interest rate off and who they cannot charge interest rate off. And the debate we had today is exactly the same debate with Greeks. Are they our brothers? Should we charge them interest rate or should we forgive? So my method was trying to read religious texts economically and see if there is anything interesting. I think there is a lot of interesting things. And trying to read economic texts religiously. So I'm doing the exact reverse. One of the things that I like to do very much, I take an economic model and I place it as if in a dream and I do a psychoanalysis of the model. What would you do if I dreamt a model of, I come to a psychoanalyst and I say, you know, I want to grow. You know, what would a psychoanalyst say? You know?
But in the same way, you say somewhere that all those texts and models should be considered as rhetorics.
Yes.
You say that somewhere.
Yes.
So could you comment on that? And especially Do you think that my question behind is the following? There is a history of rhetorics and history of formation of mathematics, precisely in the background of rhetorics, because those yeah. were developing algebra. They were
well. It's history of persuasion. What sort of arguments did people so listen?
Why
to?
Do you take this angle of persuasion? Because people could say, economy. This is not about persuasion. It's about goods. It's about exchange.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the persuasion itself. The trick in economics is that it behaves as if it's a technical, physical science. We've been trying to copy the method from physicists, but of course we cannot duck. And economics is fully and extremely moral laden. It tells you what to do. It tells you, and the normativity is hidden in the is. Mm-mm. So we say, let's suppose man is rational, and that, of course, if you said it properly using proper language, you say we believe human beings, or let's assume, or let's play a game as if, in other words, we create a myth. And the problem of our age is that we started believing our own myths. We don't have a distance from them. In the past, of course, the Greeks didn't really believe that the sun is carried by chariots. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have any better explanation. So, you know, it's like today, if somebody 200 years later would think that we believe in Star Wars or that we really believe in Lord of the Rings. No, it's a fairy tale. In some way, it, of course, it's absurd, but also a little bit we believe it in some way. That's why we like to tell our lives in these stories. And one of those stories is the story of economics. And this is the problem that we do. We economists, we say, let's create a myth that human beings are rational. Why we do it? Special purpose vehicle, so that we can calculate it better. This is the only reason why we have all these, very strange models. So in the morning we say, let's assume human beings are rational, egoistic, maximizers of utility. That's fine. It's a technical assumption. The problem is when you go into the pub in the evening and you talk with philosophers and you say, you know what? Human beings are rational, utility maximizing. It's like if a physicist makes an assumption, there is no friction of air, it's easier to calculate the free fall. But of course, it's a stupid assumption. The friction of air exists, thank God. And it's okay, it's a technical assumption, and the physicist has a distance to it. He knows that it's a myth. The problem happens between the pub and the morning, where the economist believed his own myth. It would be the same thing like if a physicist would come in the pub in the evening and say, you know what, there is no friction of air, because the calculation worked better without the friction of air, thus the assumptions are correct. So we create our own myths and believe them. And this is what I'd like to deconstruct, is the things that we don't know that we believe.
Okay, this is, frankly, I agree with this move. But what do you do with, because you took the metaphor of physics, but what is qualified as the physics of the phenomenon of economics? Things circulate. You can say that people have nightmares or fairy tales about that, but things circulate. So do you consider that this is to be taken in account, or do you consider that the only one thing to be analyzed is the fairy tale that people elaborate on this circulation?
No, I'm taking our elaboration as a fairy tale. And it's sometimes these fairy tales are useful. Lord of the Rings is also in some way useful. You get your moral, or the stories that we tell to our kids. It's a useful metaphor sometimes. Sometimes it's harmful. It depends. For example, with mathematics, every parable that you use, you have to know the limits of. You know, we're coming back to Pascal, you have to know the limits of your reason. And if I use a parable, I don't know, now that we're talking about, the New Testament, let's say Jesus is the lion from the tribe of Judah, I don't mean that he eats meat only, and that he's got yellow fluffy hair, and that he's got average lifespan of 9.5 years. I don't mean that. I have to know the limits of that parable. And the same thing, I argue, is with mathematics and the application of economics, these parables. And the problem is that we have fetishized our models, believing them too much, and really not distancing ourselves from our own beliefs. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's healthy to say, compare it, well, you know, in the past they used the Epic of Gilgamesh to bring about the same point, or, you know, in the Old Testament or New or Greeks or whatever, all these stories came up with similar conclusions that we do today, only we ridicule that. And I think this is one way how to also read the financial crisis. It's, you know, it's called credit crunch, and of course you only need to know very little basic Latin to understand that it's a faith crunch. It's a crunch, our faith, you know, the God isn't always good, the God of the markets. It's also a little mysterious, and it's also very cruel, and he wants sacrifices. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about blood circulation. This came from Harvey, the idea that, you know, blood circulates, and we've used that in economics as well. So today we need to, you know, share blood, you know, where shall we cut ourselves? What sort of budget cuts should we do in order to win the favors of gods of growth back? What sort of sacrifices? We call it, you know, we call it investment, but it's, in a way, it's a similar dynamics with sacrifices.
Okay, and you mentioned texts which are very ancient. You mentioned, let's say, more modern authors of the 17th, 18th century or recent economical texts. Does history matter? Are they dealing about the same thing? That's my point. If I would criticize your reading, which is very interesting for me, but something is lacking in my mind. It is the historicity of those texts. They don't deal with the same thing. They and even, for instance, if you have asked Adam Smith for a general law of exchange, he would have refused that because he was considering that you could not imagine a general law of exchange. He writes it in some letters. So my point is, what is the status of this interpretation, given the fact that the historicity of the phenomena changes and the historicity of its understanding changes too?
Yeah. But inevitably, that's a critique that you can give to any historical reading of the past.
No.
Anytime that you
may consider that, but
anything that you, even Shakespeare that you read, you're reading it with your eyes of the 21st century. You cannot jump out of it.
This is why you are a specialist about literature and why you are a specialist of history of ideas, history of science, and there are professionals of that.
You can do it worse or better, but there's always certain filter that you always read it from a perspective of today.
It's a strong hypothesis of you.
You cannot exit today.
No. It's your metaphysics. It's your point. It's the storytelling story. It's your metaphysics. But it can be contradicted. But it's another point. It's not me to speak, it's you to speak. So what do you do with history?
Everybody has metaphysics. This is the point, you know, just because...
That's not my point.
Yeah, no, but this is my point. Okay. You know, this is my mythology, you have your mythology, and I think it's important to admit it. So, yeah, of course, I mean, history does matter. I would even say, you know, we have this belief that at the core of economic or social behavior, it's mathematics, and philosophy, history, culture is icing on the cake. I again try to make the argument exactly the opposite. I say, no, mathematics is the tip of an iceberg of thousands of years of philosophy and of anthropology, of beliefs that have so been mortified, they appear to be rational and they appear to be firm. So every model that you take is, in a way, a story that, you know, to an unknown person who didn't study mathematics for many years, you would have to, you know, retell the story so that these mathematical equations make sense. And that's exactly where history of thought comes in. You cannot even write 1 + 1 = 2 without a lot of history coming up.
I agree with that. Yeah. For instance, I will take an example with one another author who wrote about financial anticipations, Nassim Taleb and his Black Swan theory. As you know, it's here again a bestseller. So how would you make your point different? Because his position to make clear is that because there is always something unpredictable, you should not calculate. It's not relevant to calculate, more or less. I'm simplifying. Yeah, yeah. But at some point, I could say, yes, you distrust the calculation. You say, no, this is only a rhetoric, so I don't want to hear about that. That's,
no, I think, do I push too much? No. I agree with you perfectly. Only the one word that I would disagree with you is the word only. Just because it's metaphysics doesn't mean only. Metaphysics is, or symbolic. Symbolism isn't, it's not only a symbol, it's a symbol. Symbol is sometimes even more than the phenomenon itself. Flag, for example, you know, is a stupid symbol of, you know, three colors in both of case of our nations. It's a symbol, but, you know, people are ready to die for it because exactly it's a symbol. But my point is, I think, and I agree here with Nassim Taleb, but my point is different. I'm trying to show economics in myths, beliefs, etc., but also beliefs, myths, and belief systems in economics. So I'm trying to, you know, find the link of what sort of belief are we exercising in economics. We call it assumptions, but in fact you can also call it articles of faith and the language that we use. So, you know, Nassim Taleb, I think, makes one brilliant point, which is, you know, you summed it pretty well. I'm trying to take a little bit more, let's say, maybe a little bit more philosophical and even a religious approach. Where do our beliefs come from? Why do we believe these things the way we believe them? Why did we take this crisis so religiously? Why do we feel the moment of injustice? Who has become the priests of our time? What has substituted this divine providence? So, you know, it's today we believe in unorchestrated orchestrator, you know, the invisible hand of the market, which itself is an extremely mysterious term. I mean, invisible hand of the market is a hugely mysterious term. So is animal spirits. I mean, you cannot find anything more, you know, crazy than animal spirits, and also homo economicus. You know, this is sort of the myth triangle of economics with which you can explain anything. You know, if you don't understand it, you say, okay, it must be the animal spirits. If you do understand, or you think you understand it, this is where wonderful the, you know, or the whole idea of gift, for example, that was so brilliantly talked. This is the method of economics. We teach economic Catholicism for, I say, 3 years. And then after the neophyte has been trained in this faith, we tell him of, you know, there are other religions as well. And, for example, there is this paradox of gift. And to economists, it really appears as a paradox, but to nobody else. You know, if you wouldn't go through 3 years of, okay, let me use a strong word, brainwashing of rationality, then you know, of course people give each other gifts because they like to do that. They like it, blah, 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 but it's not a paradox. And this, I think, is the trick of economics, which, for example, Samuelson, whom you mentioned 20 minutes ago, uses. You know, he tries to prove something. He spends 7 pages of meticulous mathematical proofs of a small little detail that, you know, is intuitive. And then in the middle of this proof, he says, yes, but we know that human beings are free and that human beings are rational and that markets are always right. And I continue with the proof. Mm-hmm. You know, how can you do that? How can you swallow a whole camel, you know?
I perfectly agree with you, to that. But I have a little problem with the way you evacuate rationality, because you make as if rationality was what economists believe, what is a normal behavior, or normalized behavior. I would say that the idea of rationality comes from somewhere else. And even when you use this line of argument, you underlying your argument, you are calling from a rational understanding of the text. Even doing your criticism of Samuelson, you are bringing an idea of rationality. So my question is, especially when you in the text you sent, there was the scientists, the science, the mathematicians, the they say rational, as if it was to be expelled. I'm skeptical about this rejection. I feel it a little.
No, I see what you
exaggerated.
Mean. Of course, I am exaggerating, and I have to, I think, a little bit, because I have to make my points strong. I'm not against mathematics in economics. I'm not against rationality in economics, but I think we've simply overdone it. It's become a technical discipline, and that's, you know, what goes wrong. And I think the fundamental problem of economics is that in life we have many values, and some of those values do have a price, and others do not. have a price. And no matter how good your mathematics is, you will be always running wrong solutions if only half, or we don't even know if it's 0.5% or half, 50% or 68%, or even if it's 99% of things that have a number and only 1% of things that do not have it, such as friendship, love, da da da. That 1% might be more important than the 99, which, you know, it's tautology in a way. So this is my point. Economics will never be able to be exact enough. We should give up the attempt to calculate everything and in fact, take our models, take our results with a pinch of salt. In other words, in this case, for example, when you calculate probability, I claim this isn't the only probability that you're facing. Let's say your model tells you 50 probability of event A happening, to which I would say that's not the only probability because we have a probability of the probability. We have a probability that the whole model is wrong. We have aha. We have the probability that we're running late.
Yes. So thank you very much for your very clear answers, and your point is very strong, I agree. We are playing the high gun from Arthur Schnitzel.